Hey, listeners, ever have trouble getting someone on the phone when you have a question about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day, or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. When you hear that Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan, you're probably thinking, what's the catch? Well, there isn't one. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans for just $15 a month. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. All plans come with unlimited talk and text and high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. Our producer, Sean, is a big Mint Mobile guy. Here's what he had to say.
For a fraction of the cost, Mint Mobile proved to have excellent coverage with no drop calls or unsent texts. Plus, they make it super easy for me to activate my device just by following a few simple steps online. And bam, done. It was great.
To get this new customer offer and your new three-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/literally. That's mintmobile.com/literally and cut your wireless bills to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/literally. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
What made you move out of L.A.?
I was living in East L.A., and a buddy of mine that I went to Pasadena City College with called me and said, you got to come up to Santa Barbara. I fucking love this. I got to stay here.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Literally with me, Rob Lowe. I love doing this podcast, as you guys hopefully know. And every once in a while, the best thing about it is that I get to fanboy out and, you know, just be like, what? Hey, wait, what? And today is one of those days because I'm talking to Kenny Loggins. Come on. I mean, you know, I'm all about my yacht rock. Maybe you don't know it. And I'm telling you the first time. I am, but he's so much more than yacht rock, and he's the soundtrack to my life and probably yours too. It's a tremendous career that has spanned so many moments, and I cannot wait to finally ask him if Michael Jackson ripped off his vocal style in This Is It, because I think he did. I'm going to ask him. We'll see what he says. Anyway, so here we go. Ladies and germs, Kenny Loggins. Now, do you remember when Joe Walsh lived up here?
Yeah.
I can't believe Joe Walsh lived. I can't.
A little too laid back for Joe?
Yeah, well, particularly at that time in his life, if you know what I'm saying. And yeah, I know. You do.
I played golf with Joe back then.
Really?
And we played at the Montecito Country Club, which is totally ironic that Joe was a member of the
country club. Yeah, that's definitely against the image.
Yeah. And he never used a driver. He always used an iron because he hated his drivers.
Jeez, that's a hard...
If you can hit a long, straight iron, you're probably in better shape than a crappy wood.
Wow.
For those who actually play golf, this was that was our version of Bushwood.
Oh, my God. No, well, yeah, right. Yes. Bushwood. Do you remember the first time you saw Caddyshack?
I was driving up to Santa Barbara. I had worked with John Peters when he was with Barbra Streisand. And when I met Barbara and John, and I played some stuff that I was working on, ideas for Celebrate Me Home. She loved a bunch of melodies, so we started working on melodies for Star Is Born. And then when they broke up, John went solo, and his first project was to make Caddyshack. And so he called me and said, I need your help. Come on in and check this out. It was great. I mean, he didn't need any help. He had everything just fell into place for him on that.
I made a list of my all-time favorite movies on my phone. I was just bored. I'm like, I'm going to see how far I can go with this list, how long I can get it. And Caddyshack, just for fun, it was really a good exercise, actually, if nothing else in film. And Caddyshack came up as the first comedy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because the way I did it was like movies that when they're on, you have to watch them.
Uh-huh.
That was like it was not about reviews or stature or just plain old. If you see it, you're watching it.
Yeah.
And Caddyshack, and then the quotability of it, forget
it. Yeah, every line in Caddyshack. You can't help but wonder how much of that was improvised and how much of that was really written or fleshed out.
There's a book that came out 2 years ago about the making of Caddyshack, which is really, it talks a lot about that. But I think your song is a huge part of it. I really do, because it's at the beginning and the end.
Yeah, because the gopher has to dance to it whenever possible.
Whenever possible.
Yeah, right.
I mean, and I love that the gopher is just a bad puppet.
You know,
I love that.
When I first saw the movie, it was not in the movie. It was, John said to me, oh, we're going to have a hand puppet in this part. And I thought, that's a stupid idea. That'll never work.
Well, I think it works because of the song. Because when the golf ball comes flying in.
Yeah.
And the gopher ducks and then the song hits. I mean, come on. It's movie magic.
Could look like Howdy Doody there for a minute.
I mean, there's in the canon of your movie smash songs, I mean, everybody has their favorite. I've heard yours is Footloose. Mine's for sure I'm All Right.
Yeah, I love I'm All Right too. I recorded the demo of I'm All Right here in Santa Barbara. And the drummer I used was not an extremely adept drummer. So any kind of complication idea that I had, he couldn't do. So finally, I just boiled it down to foot, snare, foot, snare, foot, snare.
You're kidding.
And it became the essential groove of I'm All Right. It's crazy how well that works.
That's under the category of happy accidents. And as you know, you've probably had your share. It's really super true. It's like, what could flummox a lesser artist, whether it's an actor, writer, producer, singer, where all of a sudden something doesn't work out and you could be really pissed or ruin it, actually ends up making it better.
Yeah.
Sometimes that really does happen.
Or just ending up showing up for something that you wouldn't have normally had to show up for.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yes.
So that's what happened with Danger Zone. I was in the studio when I wrote for Top Gun. It was a cattle call, and I was in a private theater watching a preview of the, you know, whatever edit they had with about six or seven other big pop acts.
Who else was there?
There was an R&B act that came in right behind us, about four guys. There were a couple of guys already in the theater. Mickey Thomas and the Starship was part of it. Mm-hmm. I know that REO was part of it. Oh, Toto was part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sitting there and I'm seeing all this competition around me. And then about midway through the movie comes the volleyball scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I was writing at the time with Peter Wolf, the Austrian producer. I nudged Peter and I said, nobody's going to write for this. Let's write for this scene. So that, you know, because I knew from my experience that just being a part of the soundtrack album was going to be pivotal. And it kind of didn't matter what scene you write for as long as you get in it.
Wow.
So we I think we were the only ones who submitted a song for that scene. So I was in the studio working on Playing with the Boys, which is the song we wrote. And I got a call from Giorgio Moroder's office. Giorgio was doing the bulk of the music for the movie. And he had a song, and he didn't have a singer because the band that was supposed to do it dropped out. The lawyers refused to agree about something. So they dropped out of the deal. And he said, I have to dub this song in tomorrow, and I don't have a singer for it. So can you come in and sing it? And I didn't even listen to it. I just said, is it up-tempo? Because I needed a rock and roll one for the show. And he said, oh, yeah, it's a rocker. So I went, good, I'm in. We went over lyrics and chords. I added some things, changed some words. We added a bridge. And then went in the next day and sang it. And, you know, everybody was writing for that scene. Just blind luck.
Is that the biggest of all of them? I mean, they're all huge. Is that the biggest?
Of the songs, you
yeah.
mean?
Yeah.
Actually, no, that's I found out just the other day by doing an interview that Danger Zone peaked at number two behind Peter Gabriel.
If you're going to be behind somebody, might as well be Peter Gabriel.
Right. I think it was Sledgehammer. But it peaked at two. Footloose was at number one for a while.
Have you seen, are you involved at all in the new Top Gun?
Yes.
Oh, have you seen it?
I haven't seen it yet. I saw movieola versions cut here and there. Just, they showed me scenes that they thought the song might go in.
Are they going to put Danger Zone in it?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
When I finally met Tom Cruise on Fallon about slightly before 2020 started.
No way. You'd never met him?
Never met him.
No way.
Yeah. And so, you know, I just stopped him before we went on and I said, so yes or no, is Danger Zone in the new movie? He said, we can't do Top Gun without Danger Zone.
Yeah, that's Tom. That's so cool. I'm very few movies these days get me like excited to go to, but I cannot wait.
Yeah,
for Top Gun 2.
They've got a great word of mouth. They let the press see it recently.
Ooh.
For the last year, I was not allowed to tell anyone that Danger Zone was in the movie because he loved it so much, he wanted it to be the surprise element.
Exactly, yes.
And so that when it came on, people would go
crazy.
Oh my God.
Yeah, they go crazy.
And then finally, I found out that they had to let the cat out of the bag. They did a private showing for maybe a dozen, and all the reviews were incredible. So I'm excited.
Yeah, I hear it's. I've talked to people who've seen it and just said it's the aerial footage is beyond belief in it. Insane, the stuff that they've invented for it. Do you want to know my Footloose story?
No. No, it's your show, man. Come on.
So Dean Pitchford, who wrote the script and a lot of the songs, and the late, great Craig Zaden. And it was like their first sort of big movie.
Yeah.
And I read the script and I loved it. I loved it. I know it sounds insane, but I loved it. And the music was a huge part of the script. I don't remember if they had I don't think there were even CDs in those days, but somehow a lot of the songs were already done and you could kind of listen.
Yeah. Dean and I wrote a couple of the songs to the actual paper screenplay.
There you go.
You know, there was nothing to see, but you know, when we started on it, he wanted me to write with him so that would cement him in not only as the screenwriter, but also as a songwriter.
Okay, that makes so I'm right in this memory because I remember the music was in the script. Obviously, it's about dancing. So they had, talk about cattle calls. They had a cattle call of all of the sort of, you know, appropriate fledgling movie stars of that age group. And
you do movies?
Not anymore.
Oh. So how old were you? How old were you when you went in to see that?
I would have been 20.
Wow,
I would have been 20.
Right at the beginning, perfect time for Rob Lowe to be.
Oh no, I was like it was like teed up.
Yeah,
and they loved me. Craig. It was Craig's idea to we met at I forget where we met, but they were the ones who told me about it. I didn't even know about him. My agent didn't tell me about it. And so I thought, well, this is going to happen. So I started taking dance lessons at Joe Tremaine's dance studio.
I hear you do a hell of a foxtrot.
Well, listen.
Wouldn't have come in handy.
It was not good. But I worked really, really hard for weeks for the big dance audition, which was at Paramount Studios. And they had a big cattle call dance audition. All the Paramount brass were there. And Herb Ross, who I think believed directed the movie. And this is it. This is happening. This is what we're doing. And it was, get this, I'll never forget. It was to a Styx song.
Dancing to a Styx song.
Yeah,
and we already had Footloose in the can.
Oh, it was definitely not to Footloose.
Yeah.
For sure it wasn't, which is so bizarre. And it ended with a big leap to your knees, stage slide on your knees. That's what
everyone can do that.
Not me.
They didn't teach you that at the Tremaine Dance Studio.
No. Well, I blew out my ACL.
Slide?
On the slide. I left the soundstage on a stretcher.
Oh my God.
And as I'm being wheeled out, Craig Zaden and Neil Marin and everybody are like standing over my stretcher and like, look, Rob, don't worry. I mean, we're going to hire a dancer. We need to hire, we're going to hire a dancer. We're not going to hire an actor. And 2 weeks later, they hired Kevin Bacon.
Yeah.
Oh, Hollywood.
Anything they tell you is true.
Of course.
Yeah.
Why would it be anyway?
That's the ethic of Hollywood.
Okay. So I have a theory that on the song This Is It, I've always wanted to ask you this, particularly the opening verses that you're singing, 100% Michael Jackson ripped that style off.
Really?
100%.
I've never even noticed that. I've never thought about that.
And I don't know what song it would be, but for many of them, like when he sings in that kind of breathy, sort of quasi falsetto thing, there's just no doubt in my mind that he didn't just steal it. I saw Daryl Hall and John Oates recently told a story that Michael said, he said, I hope you guys are okay that I stole your kisses on my lips. And they're like, what? And then what? When did you steal it? And there was some song that they never did the math either. So I bet you go back and listen to some of Michael's stuff, because I know you worked with him.
Yeah.
Oh, well, Michael called you for We Are the World.
Right.
That is my favorite. That video of We Are the World is, I mean, obviously everybody saw it when it came out.
But in the light of history and
yes.
the legacies
yes.
that were in that room, and watching Steve Perry coach Cyndi Lauper to sing her line, and you would watch him behind her sitting on the, and it's like got to be 1 a.m. or something, 2 maybe, and we're all exhausted. And he's sitting there just so frustrated because it's a line he could have hit his first try. And well, anything is his first try.
Right.
But, you know, and she's struggling with her line, and he's like got his head in his hands, and he's kind of hunched over like, oh my God, we're going to be here all night. It's funny. There are some very funny moments. Michael came to me. Prince was supposed to do that gig. And Prince, of course, snubbed his nose and didn't show up.
Yes.
Which is so very Prince. So there's the space. There's that sort of semicircle of soloists at
yes.
the end. And there's an open space. And Michael doesn't know what to do. And he comes to me and says, so who should stand in that place? And I said, Huey Lewis. And he said, okay. So he went and told Quincy, and they asked Huey if he would do it. And of course, he jumped at the chance.
Wow.
But, you know, looking back now in a moment of legacy, what was, for me, I had just become a fan of Huey Lewis in the News. And I loved his voice. And I thought, this is going to be an important voice for rock and roll.
I would love to know the politics of it, because any time, like who gets what, who sings where, who gets quote unquote more to do, you know, who's, you know, someone's going to be selling more records at that exact moment than someone else. And so all of that has to go into the equation of making.
Well, I think it was entirely Michael and Quincy.
Right.
And I think they just sat down, talked it over. They may have had, you know, one or two friends in on it. But it really looked like Michael was in charge. And then Quincy was sort of the strong man in the background.
Yeah. Like
whatever Quincy said, everyone did. That was just the way it was.
One of the things that kind of makes me laugh, and it's maybe just because I'm such a misanthrope, is Kim Carnes gets two words. She literally says, and we.
Oh, no.
And then everyone goes, come together as one. But it makes me laugh so hard
yeah.
because it's, she's in a soul, a solo line, and people
moment.
Are throwing down.
Yeah.
And then it gets to her and she goes, and we, that's it.
Yeah, she'll point at that to her grandkids. That right there, that's me.
That and we is me.
That's me.
That was at the top of, that's when Bruce was the biggest star in the history of music at that very moment.
Yeah. That he pulled up in some old clunker rental or something.
That's right. That's the legend. He pulls up late in some piece of shit rent-a-wreck, right?
Yeah.
And
I wonder if he did that on purpose.
For sure.
It wasn't a car he happened to have handy.
One of the things that people forget about everybody is that we're all showmen. And if we weren't showmen, we wouldn't have lasted as long as we have.
We certainly wouldn't have signed up for the gig.
For the gig in the first place.
Yeah, right.
And Bruce is one of the ultimate show, and that's part of the show.
Yeah.
Part of the show is the man of the people.
Every man. Some did it better than others.
Yes. Where else can you go surfing and skiing in the same day? Or check out a world-class art museum and camp out under a brilliant night sky same day? Or hike through the redwoods and get a luxury spa treatment? There's only one answer: California. No matter where you go across this state, you will find a way to play. I love California. And I have not yet surfed and skied in the same day, although I do both. So that is on my bucket list. It's the most beautiful place in the world. Discover why California is the ultimate playground. Head to visitcalifornia.com to start planning your trip today.
Join Macy's in an effort to shop more sustainably with brands like Carter's Little Planet, Oak, On 34th, Elemis, and more. Plus, to help bring more parks to more people, Macy's is supporting Trust for Public Lands Community Schoolyards Project, transforming vacant schoolyards into green spaces to help ensure healthy, livable communities for generations to come. Donate online or in store and learn more at Macy's.com/purpose. Thanks to Quince, I can get high-end, versatile pieces at fantastic prices. They've got killer luxury essentials that are perfect for my wardrobe. Quince has all the must-haves, like Mongolian cashmere crew neck sweaters from $50, iconic 100% leather jackets, and versatile flow knit activewear. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of middlemen and passes that savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. One of my producers tried Quince, and here's what he had to say.
I'm really excited to revamp my closet with Quince. There are so many great options at pretty unbeatable prices. I'm really excited to try out the burgundy cashmere crew neck. I love the blue chore jacket. Maybe I'll throw some joggers in there. These are great options at pretty unbeatable prices.
Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/rob for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince, quince.com/rob to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rob.
So Steve Perry, you brought him up. Huge fan. He almost makes me like the San Francisco Giants. That's how much I like.
Yeah.
That's how much I like him.
Yeah. Just to hear that song.
Just to hear that song and to go to the stadium when they play it. And he stands up and lip syncs to it. You know that, right?
Oh, I've seen photographs, but I never knew that he actually did the whole song.
He does it. It's amazing because he's a huge baseball fan. He's there all the time.
Yeah.
And I went to a World Series game and that song comes up and you're like, oh, this is pretty cool. And then you see everybody's looking in one direction. And then there he is, like leading, like Harry Carey at the Chicago Cubs leading Take Me Out to the Ball Game. The Giants have Steve Perry doing
the mascot.
Yeah. And it's what a voice.
Yeah. I recorded with Steve years ago. We did a duet that we wrote together called Don't Fight It.
Great song.
And I went up to San Francisco to record the vocal with Steve. So we're recording both of us live simultaneously, as opposed to normally, you know, he'll do his and then I'll do mine or whatever. Mm-hmm. We were both, and then between takes, he would imitate other people. And the guy was amazing. He went into, of course he's going to do a perfect Sam Cooke. We hear that in every one of his records.
Yeah.
But then he goes into Rod Stewart and he does a perfect Rod Stewart. And God knows how many other voices he could do, but he certainly found his own. I mean, it's not like only a chameleon who can only be a chameleon. He was already imitating the classic rockers of our era, and at the same time becoming one. You know, looking back in hindsight, I think that's amazing. My son Cody, he went on the road with me as a crew guy, and about two or three shows in, after watching me in the audience, he goes, "Dad, you're a rock star." He had no idea. He was like 17 years old. And had no idea, because in our, you know how it is in your home life,
yes,
in your real life, you're not a rock star. You're not nothing but dad.
You're the guy who takes out the trash.
Usually.
Yes.
Yeah.
For sure. Oh, yeah. And that's so great.
And then a couple years later, he said, "Dad, you recorded with Steve Perry?" Like, well, yeah, son.
As a matter of fact,
we hung out together.
As a matter of fact, I did. You had great collaborations, though. You had great collaborators. Michael McDonald is my all-time favorite. I was just talking to somebody the other day. Have you ever seen the hilarious, it's not Saturday Night Live, it's SCTV sketch that's based around the recording of, this is so obscure, but it's so, do you know?
Is it the Christopher Cross
yes,
thing?
It's amazing.
Yeah, well, he runs from gig because he was singing on everybody's record.
Yeah.
And imagine that the record, Warner's, I think it was, would probably have freaked out saying, you're diluting, what do you call it?
The brand?
The brand. You're diluting the brand by singing on everybody else's records. But I was really grateful that he sang on mine.
I think What a Fool Believes, which you wrote with him, it is for sure my top five songs of all time.
Man, the night we wrote that, we were up all night. When I first heard his voice was on the Doobie Brothers' Living on a Fault Line. As soon as I heard it, I went, this is going to be one of the great voices. And I was really fascinated by his style of writing, and I wanted to write with him. And I got a message that Michael was looking for me. It's because he was looking for collaborators too. And I'm unpacking the guitar out of the trunk of the car. And the door to his house is open, and I'm hearing him singing things through the door. And I hear him going, bum, 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 which ended up being the actual lyric. And I'm hearing this melody come out, and then, and he stops. And my imagination keeps going, and I'm imagining, and so I knock on the door and we say, hey, man, how you doing? Shake hands. You know that thing you were just playing? I think I know how the next part goes.
And you said, just like that.
So we immediately sat down at the piano and I sang the thing I was hearing and he worked out the chords and was like, so we were writing together before we actually met.
Well, it's a great melody, but also it's just a great concept, the concept of the song itself.
And he had that already in his hands.
Really?
He had to explain it to me about 16 times.
It isn't.
People don't realize that first line of the chorus is like three sentences long.
Yes.
What a fool believes he sees is the actual line. Mm-hmm. Not just what a fool believes. What a fool believes he sees, no wise man has the power to reason away. And what seems to be is always better than nothing.
It's amazing.
What a great fucking line.
It's amazing.
I know. So we finished.
And so true.
Exactly.
Universal truth.
Yeah. And it uses his favorite word, fool. Which if you listen to his early work, there's the word fool in every song.
Really?
Yeah, because he loved the shape of it.
Fool.
That's his thing. And it was brilliant. And we finished at 3 in the morning or so, and I went home and listened to it the rest of the night at my own house. I was just laughing, going, God, this is a big fish.
When music survives like that, and more than survives, it like becomes an iconic thing. It always has a place in your life. And for me, that song, I'll always be, and I don't mean to age you, but I will always be.
You can do that effortlessly.
Okay, here we go. I will be 15 years old, and it's my very first network television show. It filmed in front of a live audience. And as the audience is filling in, I know the audience is coming because they put in the walk-in music. And the first song is What a Fool Believes. And I'm like, man, my career is maybe happening.
At 15.
At 15.
God.
So we've kind of had, listen, it's like the bad cliche, and it's the soundtrack of your life, which is the point of your tour. It's the songs of movies.
Yeah.
Which is what you're doing now.
Yeah. I finally decided to put them all together and put them in the show. And it's an interesting show for me in that way, because it's not as emotionally centered as it is movie centered.
Mm-hmm.
And what it ends up being, though, is a pretty rock show. And I haven't really done a straight-ahead rock and roll show in a long time because I've got a lot of acoustic guitar material from the early days and ballads and things like that. But I lean very heavily on, there's only one movie that I wrote for, which was the Tigger movie that I wrote with the Sherman Brothers. The Sherman Brothers go way back in Disney legacy, and they wrote Winnie the Pooh, Winnie the Pooh, Fuzzy Little Cameo. And they even wrote earlier stuff, too. But simultaneously, or almost simultaneously with that, I wrote my Winnie the Pooh song.
You wrote it in high school?
I wrote it as a senior in high school, yeah. I was supposed to be studying for finals, and instead I wrote the song about leaving my childhood behind. Stuff that happened. I wrote Danny's song in high school, too, for my brother, Danny. It's from a very innocent place, you know. You're just kind of sitting on my bed, playing chords and hypnotizing myself. That's the, not really, really, but I mean, in that way where you get so deep into a melody and so deep into a vibe, that's all there is. And in that moment, you can be there for 6 hours and not know it. But a woman working for Disney decided to put me and the Sherman Brothers together because those two circles had never been connected.
Mm.
And her name was Bambi.
Oh my God, that's, you can't make it up.
How Disney can it get?
Yeah, you can't make that up. The Lullaby album. Again, oh my God, I put my second son to bed to that album every night. Every night.
Yeah, it works.
Oh, it's so good.
Thank you. And you know, the parents usually go to sleep before the child.
Yeah, it's, and I listened to it last night. Yeah. And it put me, you know,
right back there. Which one of your kids?
John Owen, my youngest.
Uh-huh. Yeah, my 23-year-old uses it if she gets an anxiety attack when she's off at school. She would put the record on to help her go to sleep.
There are a lot of great songs on it. The reworking of Pooh Corners is killer. It's, I mean, if you're listening out there and you're a dad, we've all heard Pooh Corner, great song in and of itself, but the reworking on the what's the title of the album?
Return to Pooh Corner.
Return to Pooh Corner. There you go. Listen to that one. It's killer. The other thing though, why is the song Rainbow Connection so powerful? What is it about that song?
It's a great song. That's a Paul Williams song.
Yeah, I know.
I first heard that song where I really heard it, really got it, was listening to the like first or second grade class at Montecito Union sing that song.
Oh my God.
And I went, oh, that's a perfect song. You know, why? It's just lyrically brilliant. But two things I had to do to change the song. It was originally recorded by Kermit.
Kermit the Frog,
of course.
Jim Henson. And noted vocalist.
Right. That's amazing.
Amazing.
So I changed that. I changed it to a more straight melody over the same chords. And then the bridge, which I don't remember because I didn't record it. I didn't record the whole lyrical bridge on it because I didn't feel the song needed it. So I took some liberties.
There's
with
a bridge
song.
In Rainbow Connection in the Kermit version that's not in your...
It's not in my version.
I'm going to go to listen to that.
And so I finally heard from Paul Williams after the record came out. And I said, so Paul, what'd you think? And he said, so why did you drop the bridge?
That reminds me of a story that Glenn Frey tells about Tom Waits when the Eagles redid Old 55.
Oh, yeah?
Tom Waits song. Tom hated it. Hated it. I mean, Tom Waits is like this, and the Eagles are those packed, stacked, gorgeous harmonies in that song.
Mm-hmm.
And Glenn goes, he hated it. He liked it a lot better when he got the royalties.
Yeah. He loved the check.
Yeah. You and I ran into each other once a while ago, and you had done Bridge Over Troubled Water at our mutual friend Bobby Smith's
funeral.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you crushed it. And I was like, how can you still hit the voice? And you said, because I never really stopped singing. You like, you had a theory.
I blame it on the divorces.
I didn't want to say it. Okay, you said it. I didn't want to say it, but that's exactly what you said.
I knew what you were thinking, though.
Yeah, you said, well, I've got to pay for those divorces, so I've never stopped singing.
I've had to stay on the road. I probably would have pulled way back like so many artists from the 70s and 80s, but I just kept going because, you know, you got to pay whatever you got to pay.
The great David Foster, who I know you know. I mean, he's like, in his act, he says, you know, this is the song that paid for this tour.
Yeah, right.
Which song, what did you do? I know you did a couple things, David.
Oh, God. Well, Forever, you know, mm-hmm. Forever in my heart.
Oh, of course.
The live version, Forever, dude.
Yeah.
Right. And that was one of the notes I was afraid of, actually. It's got, every year it would get a little bit higher.
Stevie Nicks.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great collaboration. That song was massive.
Yeah. Well, Stevie was at the peak of her power at that time. That was after Rumors. And she was incredibly generous, you know, offering to sing on, you'll call me when you have a song that you think will work. And I just finished that song up. That's an interesting story about tenacity or knowing your own, hearing your own star or whatever. Words to me are a plaything. And that I had this melody. And I thought, this really feels like a Mike McDonald melody to me. So I'm going to sing.
Whenever I call you friend. It's the bad Michael McDonald.
I was looking to see exactly who you were imitating there.
It was not Stevie and it wasn't you. It was Michael McDonald. Yeah.
And So I took the song, the melody idea to Michael, and I said, what do you think? He said, I don't hear it, man.
No, that's...
And so he didn't like it. So I put it away, and I thought, God, I thought it was good, but maybe it's not because I trust him so much.
Yeah.
And then a few days later, I'm writing with Melissa Manchester. And I said, well, I got this. She said, what else do you have? Anything we can work on? I said, well, I've got this one melody I really liked, but I'm not sure about it anymore. She said, well, let me hear it. So I sang it to her, and she started blocking out the chords. And the next thing, it was Whenever I Call You Friend. She loved it.
Wow.
But I said, you got to forgive me on this one. Stevie Nicks said she wants to sing something with me. I think it would be a good idea to take this to Stevie.
Right.
And she was totally cool with that because, you know, Stevie was the biggest female vocalist in the world.
And guess what? She liked the check.
There you are again.
That's a voice. You know it's her when she opens up her mouth.
I love Stevie. And I will say, I give her the cred for really breaking my solo career because I had just gone solo. It was okay. Things weren't working exactly the way I'd imagined. And then she did the duet with me and it took off.
Looking for a sparkling, clean bathroom without so much hassle? Wet and Forget Weekly Shower Cleaner is here to revolutionize your cleaning future. Just spray today, rinse tomorrow, and voila! Enjoy a sparkling, clean shower and tub without any scrubbing. It's the secret to a hassle-free, clean bathroom that many are discovering. With over 33,000 five-star reviews, Wet and Forget Weekly Shower Cleaner has proven its effectiveness on shower glass, fixtures, tiles, and more, ensuring everything shines with minimal effort. This product has gained a loyal following thanks to its once-a-week application that makes it a standout in the cleaning aisle. Join the ranks of satisfied users who enjoy more me time and less clean time with Wet and Forget Weekly Shower Cleaner, available at Amazon, Lowe's, Menards, Home Depot, and Ace Hardware. It's the perfect choice for anyone wanting to simplify their cleaning routine. Don't miss out on a chance to transform your bathroom cleaning with just one application a week. Pick up a bottle of Wet and Forget Weekly Shower Cleaner today and join the thousands who've already made the switch to effortless clean. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. I know that for me, people are out, people are about, people want to do stuff, and we want to do it, but it can be a grind. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapist at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Rob Lowe today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Rob Lowe.
I love fast cars, but there aren't a ton of high-performance EVs. They're certainly out here, there, but when I get a chance to get behind the wheel of one, I love it, and I was blown away by the Kia EV6 GT. When you get behind the wheel of the Kia, it is literally like being in a state-of-the-art rocket ship, but also comfortable. The thing goes from 0 to 60 in 3.4 seconds. It is the premium driving experience, and of course, it's an EV, so the climate thanks you. SiriusXM provides access to over 165 channels in the vehicle: music, sports, news, comedy, yacht rock. Let's go. Little Steely Dan going in your Kia. Come on now. So check it out today. It is the all-electric Kia EV6 GT. I had a blast checking it out. Believe me, you should do it yourself via kia.com/EV6 to learn more. That is kia.com/EV6 Kia, movement that inspires.
I loved your book, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that is an influence for me now as I'm writing mine.
Really?
Yeah, the level of humor and candor.
Oh, thank you.
I really appreciate that. And I want to try and bring as much humor to my book as I can. And that's, you know, when you think about all those ridiculous things that happen, a lot of them are pretty funny.
Yeah. The reason I wrote it was, and if you haven't read it, I would highly recommend reading David Niven's book, The Moon's a Balloon. So obviously, David Niven was the great character actor and sort of bon vivant of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And he wrote what is pretty much considered the ultimate memoir. And it was huge success, number one, sold forever.
Did he do Empty Horses?
Yes, he did. That was number two. That was the second book, Bring on the Empty Horses, which is also good. But that Bring on the Empty Horses is him writing about specific people. Like there's a Errol Flynn chapter, and which is great. But the other, you've got to read it. It's brilliant. And what my takeaway was, he figured out a way to hit the bullseye that I tried to hit about being dishy and giving the stuff that people are like, whoa, no way. But in a way where it's completely the high road, nobody gets hurt. And if anybody ends up looking like an idiot, it's him.
Oh.
That's the secret sauce.
You're right.
And you must have insane stories. Like I could read an entire book of you talking about the We Are the World recording. Honestly, that could end up being...
My biggest issue with this book is that there's so much shit I don't remember. And it pisses me off because I know there were great moments that I was so busy moving on to the next thing that I wasn't as present within my life as I wish I'd been. But there was so much going on, you know, in my life that there were things like that that people may find really interesting years later that for me was just a gig. I just was showing up to do my vocal on that song.
That in and of itself, though, is interesting. Really?
Yeah.
I mean, because people will think...
A book called Stories I Don't Remember.
Stories I wish my mind were... But that's what's part of your life that makes it interesting is it was and continues to be so big that what would be a headline to someone else, you would think, for you is just a gig.
Yeah.
Do you have a title yet?
Still All Right.
It's great. I mean, sitting there with the canon of titles and you want to do something with the titles,
yeah,
that would be fun to be like, yeah, is it, you know, Celebrate Me Home? Is it something like
Celebrate Me Home was one of the contenders. Yeah.
It's a great one.
Yeah.
That's my mother wore that album out.
And I kind of ignored that song. Originally, it's in 6/8, like sort of the rock and roll gospel waltz time. But it was originally, I wrote it in 4/4.
Really?
Yeah. And it was like, please celebrate me, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then when I showed it to Phil Ramone, when Phil produced my first album, I showed it to Phil and he said, that should be in 6/8. That's a gospel tune. And it certainly was. And then all I had was that line, which I thought was like a filler line, like Scrambled Eggs was a filler line for McCartney's Yesterday.
Yep.
So I thought, because no one had ever put it that way. No one ever said, celebrate me home. It's not a normal sentence. And he said, dude, that's how they'd say it on the street. So wow. I ran up to his office upstairs and wrote the whole lyric.
How many filler lyrics survive in general?
Not very many. But what happens is the spaces that they take, I like to consider them gospel, you know. For example, celebrate me home. Please, 2, 3, 4, celebrate. So if I replace that lyric, it would still be da ba dam bam bam. So I would have those syllables become the important elements of that melody. That's what syncopates the melody. When I'm mentoring teenagers and stuff, young songwriters, I come up with things that I think, yeah, that's kind of a rule I've written by. I've never really said it out loud. Because, you know, as we get older, I think we become masters at whatever trade we're in. And for me, I hadn't really thought of myself that way, that I am now like a master at what I do. And it's ironic because that's when they put you out to pasture.
I know the minute you're a master, they're not interested.
then you got to move on because, you know, you're done.
But it's really, and that's, by the way, you could just do an entire chapter on that in the book. Just do a segue of like deep dive songwriting stuff. I would love that.
People find that stuff interesting. Some people find it interesting.
Listen, I wrote in the second book I did, an essay about sending my kid to college. And I was like, it's not really the tone of the book. I don't think anybody, I had to write it. Just, I wrote it as a cathartic exercise for myself. And I was like, who cares? It became the thing that launched the second book and people share it now every year.
Really?
Yeah. It's like parents and they, like I just the other day said, oh, God, I read your essay about sending my kid to college. I just sent my kid off. And you just don't know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You gave me an idea to put in the book is when my first son was out of high school, Crosby, and he was hanging out with the wrong kind of people, you know.
The Montecito rats.
The Montecito people. You weren't the first. You were the first Montecito rat.
Yeah, right? I was. I surely was. I'm the biggest rat of all.
Set the tone for the rest of us.
Yes.
Anyway, we were building a home in Hawaii. So to get him away from the drug culture, I sent him to Hawaii, of all places. He went kicking and screaming. And it was the first of my children to really leave the nest.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a song with Mark Mancina called Always in Always. And it was basically a really sad goodbye song. Little did I know that he'd be back in 6 months. But when he went, he was like kicking and screaming and don't make me leave. And my life is here in Santa Barbara. And then the day he landed in Hawaii, he called me and said, what was I crying about? You just sent me to Hawaii?
Yeah, right.
Like, oh, welcome home.
That's the kind of stuff that you just never know. I mean, I know I would love to hear the 10 Commandments of Songwriting by Kenny Loggins. Are you fucking kidding me? I would definitely love that.
I'll work on it.
Who do you think, give me your top five songwriters from the 60s to today.
Well, Jimmy Webb would be one of the top.
Wow.
Yeah, because he just wrote such great songs.
Yeah, he did.
We could just spend half an hour breaking down his tunes. And I know people would go, Jimmy Webb, really? Yeah, Jimmy Webb.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Lennon McCartney and Dylan and the go-tos. I think Tom Petty.
Yes, me too.
Great rock writer.
I agree.
Hard to really delineate. But my era is slightly ahead of yours, of course, and it was male-dominated, so there weren't a lot of female songwriters, but Carole King,
I was going to say Carole King.
Carole King is up there as one of the top.
Yeah.
I took my daughter, Hannah, who at the time was 16, to see Beautiful.
Oh, I never saw it. I wanted
to. Really good, and the girl that plays Carole King is so good that people, by the end of the play, they believe she is Carole King.
Wow.
And they stand up and applaud for her as if she was.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
My daughter was very shy about performing, Hannah, her name is, as in Hannah Maui. And so was Carol when she was young. So I called Carol up the next day and said, would you text my daughter and just give her some words of encouragement?
Oh my God.
that's the advantage that we have being in the business, that we know these people. So the next day my daughter runs up to me and says, Dad, I just got a text from Carole King.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That is some proper fathering.
That's fathering.
Yeah, that is proper fathering. Yeah, I think for me, it's Paul Simon, Dylan, I agree, Tom Petty, Jackson Brown.
Jackson, great writer.
You know who else is great? Like, I mean, it's got a formula, but he came in and it was John Fogerty. I mean,
oh yeah.
John wrote some, I mean.
Yeah. There was a movie, was it Bad Moon Rising, that was, they used his song as the theme song?
Well, first of all, I don't think any character in a movie can go to Vietnam without one of John's songs playing.
You're talking about Jim Morrison.
Yes. Well, that was the ultimate. The ultimate.
You're standing next to the Jim Morrison is like.
That's the ultimate.
That was Vietnam.
Yeah.
Sometimes in concert, I'll just break into Love Me Two Time, Baby.
Love Me Twice Today. That was
not necessarily a great songwriter, but a great personality, like John Wayne was to movies.
Morrison was to music. When he sang like John Wayne, when you think about it, I mean, he sang music the way John Wayne acted. If you really think about it,
it's all always,
well, I'm gonna tell you,
love me two times, well, yeah, baby.
We've cracked a lot of the codes today, but I knew we would. I knew you and I would have a great talk. Thank you for coming in. This is so much fun for me. I've been looking forward to it forever because I'm a huge fan, and I know you as a neighbor over the years, and it's always great to see you. And
thank you. I appreciate that.
Wow, I got to talk to Kenny for another 5 hours and gone even deeper into my nerddom on 70s, 80s yacht rocky pop. So thanks for listening, everybody. What a fun one. I hope you had as much fun as I did. And now let's have a little gander at the lowdown line.
Hello, you've reached literally in our lowdown line, where you can get the lowdown on all things about me, Rob Lowe. 323-570-4551. So have at it. Here's the beep.
Hey, Rob. This is Virginia, personal chef here in Charlottesville, Virginia. Yep, I'm Virginia in Virginia. And I was wondering, I've kind of been dying to know, the character that you played on Californication, I'm wondering how much of that is ad-libbed and how much is scripted? And even if there was a script, like, what did this script include? Because there's no way that someone can script out that character that you wrote in there. And also, coincidentally, I was watching View from the Top or something like that with Gwyneth Paltrow in it, and you had like a cameo on there as the pilot. And I was wondering, how do you get a spot like that? Did you just happen to be in the stage next door and they were filming and they said, hey, do you want to be a spot in the movie? Or like, how does that work? So I'll talk to you soon. Okay, bye.
Thank you for checking in. Okay, so Eddie Nero in Californication, it might be my favorite character I've ever played. It might be. I mean, it's certainly up there with Chris Traeger on Parks and Recreation and Sam Seaborn on The West Wing. So a lot of it was written. I have to say they did a really good job with the dialogue, but I definitely improvised a bunch of stuff, mostly the physical stuff, which cannot be even described on a family podcast. View from the Top with Gwyneth Paltrow, I did because Gwyneth is one of my oldest friends. I've known her since she was 16, and Mike Myers and I are old friends, and he was in it too. So it was really just, we're all doing a movie. Do you want to come in and do something? And we had fun. And one of the most uncomfortable things I've ever had to do was make out with GP, because it's like making out with my sister. Thanks for the question.
I will see you next week. Don't forget to download the entire season, by the way, of Literally with me, Rob Lowe.
You've been listening to Literally with Rob Lowe, produced and engineered by me, Rob Schulte. Our coordinating producer is Lisa Berm. The podcast is executive produced by Rob Lowe for Low Profile, Jeff Ross, Adam Sachs, and Joanna Solitaroff at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson at Stitcher. Our talent bookers are Gina Batista, Paula Davis, and Britt Kahn, and music is by Devin Torrey Bryant. Make sure to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and we'll see you next week on Literally with Rob Lowe.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Stitcher.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Need a cold coffee with a bold flavor? Dunkin' Cold K-Cup Pods were specially crafted for cold coffee. Brew over ice straight out of the Keurig coffee maker for smooth, delicious Dunkin' taste you know and love. Find your next Dunkin' Cold coffee in the roasted coffee aisle.